Welcome to Pound the Rock, the Scores NBA podcast. I'm Joe Wolfond, and joining me to talk about the first round of the NBA playoffs, we are about a week into the first round at this point, is my co-host, Joseph Cacciaro. Talk to me, Cash.
Let's talk playoffs, Wolfond. My favorite time of year. I mean, there are lots of times during the season where I'll probably tell you it's my favorite time of year, but I think the amount we have to talk about early in the playoffs makes it always one of my favorite episodes. This kind of like first ep where we actually get to dig into real playoff basketball, not just looking ahead to the series. Always a treat to do that with you. So happy to do it this morning.
I'm happy to do it as well. And we've got a lot of ground to cover today, so I don't want to waste too much time. But I just, before we jump into the series on a granular level and start talking about the micro in each matchup, I wanted to get your take on any, I guess, macro trends that you've noticed. And if we're looking at the playoffs so far as a whole, what's something, if anything, that's stood out to you?
Oh, man, that's a good question. I feel like the easier generic answer would just be that like offense has further cratered from its second half slowdown. You know, I wrote a few weeks ago about how we might already be seeing a kind of that scoring boom plateau, or NBA offense and scoring plateauing, and how the second half of the season played into that with the, you know, slightly altered officiating and everything. But the decrease in scoring from even the second half of the season to the playoffs has been pretty jarring. But I will say I don't think it's been jarring in like a completely aesthetically displeasing way. You know, it's not like, I don't think games ever have become too mucked up for the most part. I think it's, you know, the defense has been solid. Like, things are ratcheted up this time of the year. I do think the officials have been letting them get away with some stuff. In some cases,
these games have been really physical.
Yes, and I like that. But in some cases, they've let them get away with way too much. So I guess that's probably off the top of my head. What I would say is a decrease in scoring, but that has still produced an entertaining brand of ball. Like, I don't think it's been bad, or like, it doesn't seem like we're going back to the Stone Age with it. And then real quick, I'd say too, and I know other people have kind of talked about this in the days since the playoffs started, but also just, you know, the importance of not necessarily depth, but of like quality role players this time of year. I know we do talk about how the playoffs are for stars and superstars, and I still think that's the case, and it always will be, and especially as you get deeper into the playoffs, I think that's the case. But I think early in the playoffs, you do see, and you're seeing it again this year, where, like, you know, it is really important to complement your star players with really solid role players, ideally two-way role players that are, you know, for lack of a better term, playoff proof, that can, you know, rise to the occasion. And like, top of my head, Josh Hart is one of those guys. When we talk about Knicks Sixers eventually, like, you can make the argument that the Knicks were up 2-0 in a series against Joel Embiid and Tyrese Maxey 76ers with Josh Hart being the best player in the series through two games. Like, that's kind of nuts.
I don't know if I would go that far, but yeah, he's been tremendous. And I do want to talk about his role in that series.
Just to be clear, he has not been the best player in the series through three games. Through the first two games, I thought he was in the discussion.
Yeah, so like, the physicality of these games has really popped to me. That's what's been apparent. And from a numbers perspective, if we're using the cleaning the glass filter, average offensive rating in the playoffs so far is 112, which is down from 115.6 during the regular season. Even after the All-Star break, when things slowed down, it was around 114. And that's down to 112 in the playoffs so far. And that's also down from the playoffs last year, which was 113.5. So we're definitely seeing, I think, a furthering even of those like revised officiating points of emphasis or interpretations when it comes to contact. And I think it's been a net positive. Like, I think there are definitely some times where I'm like, maybe you've overcorrected on this. But I think for the most part, it's led to a very entertaining product. And yeah, I want to get into talking about all of that. So let's dive into the individual series, Cash. Where do you want to start? Do you want to, like, because it's maybe fresher in your mind, talk about the games that happened last night, or do you want to go somewhere else?
Let's talk Knicks Sixers off the hop, not even just because it's the freshest in our minds, but I think it's probably the game and or series that's most talked about after last night, if that makes sense. So I say let's start there. I mean, I already mentioned the, you know, like the Josh Hart thing, how I thought through the first two games, it was pretty awesome that he had a claim to being the best player through the first two games of a series in which the Knicks led 2-0. Obviously, Joel Embiid then just absolutely explodes, mostly in the second half of game three. I mean, I think there's a lot to unpack with Embiid's game three, and I wrote about it this morning, but on the positive side, what an awesome example of just how outrageous his skill set is at his size when it's like this guy's knee is clearly still not right. He's hobbling up and down the floor a lot of the game. He's also dealing with Bell's palsy, which I know like maybe some would say, well, that doesn't necessarily affect his game. I mean, he's got like weakened facial muscles on one side of his face that makes it hard for him to like fully open his mouth on that side and blink his left eye. Like, I feel like that would definitely make it more challenging, at least on some degree, even psychologically, to play basketball. So there's that. But this guy that physically with the knee is clearly not 100%, doesn't have the same explosiveness. The one time he threw down a dunk, he crumpled to the floor. Doesn't have the raw power he usually has to be able to dominate guys inside the way he usually would. So it's like, you know, most guys that size, that'd be a real problem. With Joel Embiid, it's like, nah, I'll just bury you under a hail of jumpers and score 50 points on 68% shooting anyway, despite the fact all I can really do is shoot jumpers right now. Like, just outrageous. 19 to 21 from the free throw line. Awesome, awesome offensive performance. By the way, I checked last night too. Sixth time in NBA playoff history that a player has scored at least 50 points on a field goal percentage that high. Just, like, outrageous stuff. Obviously, we do have to talk about the fact that had his first quarter flagrant foul been called correctly, I'd say, he probably shouldn't have been in the game to score 50 points over the course of it, because what he did to Mitchell Robinson, look, I know I've talked before about how because of Embiid's size, when he flops, like a lot of other players flop, not just him, it just ends up more reckless and hazardous because of how big he is. This was not a case of just a irresponsible flop. Like, even for his biggest supporters, I think it would be very tough to argue against the fact that he was trying. Yeah, and Wolfon pointing to himself right now on camera because he is one of his biggest supporters. But I'm sorry, like, you can't tell me that. Not like that in that moment, he was not trying to hurt Mitchell Robinson on some level. Like, he pulled a guy in midair, and he said after the game, like, he was just trying to protect himself because he always ends up on the wrong end of things. But, like, this wasn't bracing yourself because a guy's coming on. This was you pulling a guy down. If anything, he was going to land on top of you if you got what you wanted. Like, that was just such Bush League crap. And again, as I wrote about and this morning, it's like all the good things I said about his offense performance and all that, he wouldn't have had the opportunity to do that had he been kicked out for that, and probably should have been kicked out. And then even after that, throughout the first half, just continued to teeter on the edge of getting himself tossed. Like, whether it was more than usual, even like being overly aggressive, getting in officials' faces, like after every single whistle he didn't agree with. There was one time where like him and Jalen Brunson were kind of jockeying for position, and he like really aggressively like whipped his hands down in Brunson's direction, where it's like, if he had made contact there, probably a flagrant, and that's, he's out of the game. There was the play where he flails his leg while shooting a jumper that I'm pretty sure he made, because he made what seemed like every jumper last night, and kicked Mitchell Robinson in the groin. Like, there were so
after
many...
already having picked up a technical for kneeing Isaiah Harden's spine in the groin.
And already having picked up the flagrant for the play on which he probably should have been ejected. And so it was all very much, it was like, you know, in a game the Sixers could least afford for it to happen because they were down 2-0. He lost the plot in the first half. And I love, like, your text response to me, I thought was great. Like, elite plot loser, Joel Embiid. And I know you're being, you know, a little tongue-in-cheek, but I do think it's a fair statement, because we've seen this in the past with him. Not necessarily where he does something where it's like he should be tossed, but where when the Sixers and his own backs are against the wall, he does seem to lose the plot. And they just can't have that. What they need, and what Joel Embiid needs, frankly, for his postseason legacy, is for him to let the outrageous skills that were on display in the second half do all the talking. Because when that's the case, Joel Embiid can talk the talk, you know, a couple nights ago saying we're still going to win this series, and then come out 72 hours later and walk the walk despite the fact that he literally can't walk on like full power right now. So please, Joel, just like let those outrageous skills do all the talking and stop letting this kind of like foolishness that always accompanies the injuries, unfortunately, this time of year.
Yeah, and I mean, I didn't see his post-game comments, and that's really disappointing and super whack that he tried to defend it rather than just coming out and owning it and apologizing. Like, there's no excuse. I 100% thought that he deserved to get tossed. And I know I've seen some Sixers fans kind of pointing to there was a DiVincenzo play earlier this season where there was like a scrum under the basket and he pulled down, I think it was Oubre that he pulled down by the legs. Not condoning that either, but that is different than grabbing a guy by the legs and trying to pull him down while he is going up. It's just an incredibly dangerous play that could easily lead to an injury, and I got no time for that shit. Even though I have all the time in the world for Joel Embiid as a whole, as you know. But yeah. I think he deserved to get tossed for that. That would have almost certainly led to the Sixers losing, being down 3-0, and basically the end of their season. And oh boy, what an offseason of doubts and questions that would lead to if that had been how the Sixers season ultimately ended. And like, they might still lose this series. The odds are that they will, right? Like, the Knicks are still probably favored in this series. I think it could kind of go either way at this point, but like, the Knicks are still in the driver's seat and this could still be how it ends. But obviously it's a potentially huge pivot point if the Sixers can come back and win the series. And even if they don't, if Embiid can kind of just keep playing the way that he's been playing through the physical ailments that he's dealing with, that is a significant difference. Like, going into the offseason having lost a hard-fought series where he played out of his mind versus going into the offseason having been either swept or gentlemanly swept, in large part because he cost his team a game by doing some dumb shit. And I don't know how to reckon with all of that, but I would like to be able to focus on the basketball, and the basketball in the second half was sublime. You made an important point, which is that it has been very much driven by jump shooting. Like, because he is not, I don't think, trusting that knee, especially in a crowd, the Knicks are feeling comfortable doing a lot of late switching on these pick and rolls with Maxey, where they feel okay about their bigs late switching onto Maxey, and they feel okay about their smaller guys late switching onto Embiid, because he's either popping to the three-point line or he's short rolling to the free throw line. And from there, they can kind of pinch in, muck up his driving lanes, and basically put him in a situation where he's got to either decide if he trusts that knee enough to attack or if he's just going to fall back on his jumper. And I think the Knicks can kind of live with him falling back on his jumper. But of course, the thing about the way that Embiid has rounded out his game, especially over the last 3 or 4 years, we saw the three-point shooting last night, but really it's been him becoming just one of the best mid-range jump shooters in basketball. And so if it's like, oh, hey, here's Jalen Brunson now who's guarding Joel Embiid at the free throw line, your instinct might be like, oh, okay, Joel, go and like put Jalen Brunson in the basket. But it's kind of easier for him to just like turn around and shoot over Brunson, and that's almost like a layup for him with the way that he's shooting. He did have one really nice drive, I thought, where I think it was Deuce McBride who switched onto him at the free throw line. And he drove through the Knicks stunting help and swooped in for like a soft little finger roll. And I thought that was just gorgeous. And one of the threes that he hit out of the pick and pop where the Knicks late switched it, and Brunson was like, I was going to say chest to chest with him. I don't think that's possible given the size disparity. Head to belly. Brunson was, yeah, like up in his shit. And he hit that three anyway. I mean, he was masterful. And even like, he's not moving around particularly well on defense, but is still a massive deterrent at the rim just by virtue of being out there and having the defensive instincts that he has. So, yeah, look, I think him and Maxey have been the two best players in this series. And I honestly would have said that after the first two games as well. That's why it was so crazy that they were down 2-0. Brunson, you know, he'd put up some decent counting stats, but he was shooting 29% from the field and 17% from three after those two games. Finally shook loose and had a big, big game in game three. But like, the Knicks won those first two games because their supporting cast just demolished Phillies. And this is where we can get into talking about Josh Hart. We can talk about Hartenstein. I think part of it does have to do with the way that Brunson has been defended versus maybe how the Knicks have chosen to defend Maxey and Embiid, and specifically their two-man action. Like, I think it's been more help conscious on Philly's front, and that has helped these Knicks support players get going. Like, Hart especially, it's clear that Philly wanted to make him their kind of primary help point, right? They're putting Lowry on him, and if Hart is above the break, one pass away from Brunson, Lowry is parked at the nail in, like, aggressive gap help. And, like, there have been a couple of cases. They didn't do it a ton, but they did it a lot at the end of game one, where Lowry's guarding Hart, and he is ready to intercept whichever Knicks center is on the floor coming up to set a ball screen for Brunson. And then it's like a pre-switch. He's going to be defending that action so Embiid can stay close to the basket. And then Embiid is functionally guarding Hart after that, but really it's just Hart being wide open. So the result of this is that Josh Hart has attempted more wide open threes by the NBA.com definition than any player in the playoffs so far. And he has hit 9 of those 16 wide open threes, shot 12 for 23 from deep overall. In that coverage where Lowry is in gap help, it can be like a one pass away advance from Brunson to Hart on the wing, and he can pop that three. But he is quick enough to also just explode into that diagonal gap with like a stampede cut and get all the way to the rim, or make a kick out on the move that's setting somebody else up for an open three, or a laydown pass to Hartenstein. And he's feasted off of those laydown passes in this series. And then also like capitalizing on the inattention by crashing for offensive rebounds. He's got 11 offensive rebounds through three games. The Knicks have rebounded 39% of their own misses in the series. So I think, look, they're a great offensive rebounding team. The Sixers are a poor defensive rebounding team. But I think you're also seeing a little bit, like, they're a little more willing to get their defense bent out of shape to take Brunson away than the Knicks have been to take Maxey and or Embiid away. And I think that's part of what's allowing, A, some of the role players to get going, and B, like, the team as a whole to grab all of these offensive rebounds. So,
yeah, and just to add to that, yeah. I also think Embiid's knee is a big part of that as well, because you see it in, like, you mentioned him not trusting it in traffic. He, and I mentioned him not having the explosiveness, even just to, like, the quickness to get off the ground, which he usually displays at his size. He doesn't have that explosiveness. He's not getting off the ground well, and he doesn't trust it in traffic or with guys around him. So there have been plenty of times where, like, a defensive rebound will be there for the taking that a healthy Embiid would snare easily with the guys around him on the Knicks. But in this series and in his physically diminished state, he's not able to get it, whether it's like jumping up to get it, whether it's fighting off a crowd to get it, whether it's being the first to get a loose ball after it caroms off the rim. Like, there have been so many times when I've seen that happen. And it's like healthy Embiid gets that defensive rebound. But in this case, for the reasons that you mentioned in terms of the way the Sixers defense is being bent, with Embiid not healthy, and then also given the fact the opponent is the best offensive rebounding team in basketball, it's led to a situation where they're only friggin' cleaning up 60% of their opponent's misses. Like, not good enough.
Yeah, this is an amazing stat. So the Knicks' first shot half-court possessions, 91.4 points per 100. That's 15th in the playoffs. Overall, 121.5 offensive rating, first in the playoffs. That is what their offensive rebounding has enabled them to do. And it's like some of that is transition as well, like, because we're talking about half-court possessions. Like, that's like the combination of transition and offensive rebounding, but mainly for the Knicks, that is their second chance generation, which, like, Hartenstein, Mitchell Robinson, it's mainly been those three guys kind of crashing and coming up with those O-boards. DiVincenzo has been in there mixing it up as well. But yeah, I think part of it is scheme, and part of it is just them kind of like out-hustling and out-working the Knicks when it comes to getting some of these loose balls. And like you said, Embiid not doing a particularly good job on the glass because he doesn't have any explosion off the ground. So that's been really interesting. And like the Knicks aren't really selling out to stop Brunson at like the point of the screen. There were a few times last night because he really got going where they actually just like blitzed him. But that hadn't really been their strategy up to that point. It was more like what we saw the Heat do to him last year, where the help is coming at the second layer of defense. And that's what's creating those opportunities. And that's when Hartenstein is sort of like forming up around his drives and finding those little soft pockets in the Philly defense. And his ability to hit that push shot from like 8 feet has been so valuable. Like, he's been awesome in this series.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like DiVincenzo obviously hitting the massive three to win game two. Ananobi has hit some big threes, and his defense on Maxey has been terrific. Like, Maxey's done a lot of damage, but he's done way more damage against other matchups. And a big part of Philly's tactics, I feel like, have been to get other guys switched onto him. Sometimes, like, Deuce McBride gets the matchup, and he works hard, but he's not nearly the screen navigator that OG or even, like, DiVincenzo is. And he just loses contact, and when Maxey gets that separation, whether it's stepping into the pull-up three or getting downhill like for a floater, is so deadly. But against OG, he's kind of struggled. And so what they've done a lot is like they want to get Brunson in the action. They want to do like a double ball screen where Brunson has to switch onto him after the first screen and then navigate the second one. That's been very effective for them. And by the way, the Knicks have done the exact same thing, trying to get Maxey into the matchup against Brunson. I just think Maxey's done a way better job than Brunson has in that matchup when the switch has been given. But yeah, overall, I just think the Knicks supporting cast, even after last night when the Sixers finally did get some offensive contributions from somebody other than Embiid or Maxey, because like Kelly Oubre sort of stepped up, Cam Payne came through with like 11 huge points off of the bench. Apart from that, like, they've just been thoroughly dominated by New York's supporting cast. And if that continues, like, I do think Embiid and Maxey are good enough that they can win the series regardless, but it's going to be really tough sledding. Like, they need to get more. And I just, the Tobias Harris thing, he's so invisible at both ends of the floor. I would seriously consider starting Batum over him at this point.
Yeah, Tobias Harris might be the definition of a guy who doesn't want that smoke in the playoffs.
Like, when Embiid is on the bench, first of all, I tweeted out these stats last night. With Embiid on the court in the series, that's 116 minutes, and the Sixers are plus 33. 28 minutes with him on the bench, they're minus 32. Okay? And, like, obviously Maxey's out there in those minutes, and he's the one who's being relied upon to carry the offense. But you would hope that Harris, who is also often out there in those minutes to supply that extra offensive punch, could do a little bit more to contribute. And he's just not. He's invisible. He fades into the background. He blew a bunch of defensive rotations last night as well. And I just think Batum's been like better and more valuable than he has in this series. And Batum, by the way, as a one-on-one matchup for Brunson, I think has been the best Sixers defender. Yeah. Even though Oubre's gotten the bulk of that assignment, I think Batum's been the best one. So I'd consider giving him even more run and giving less to Harris at this point. Anyway, lots of interesting stuff going on in that series. Lots of interesting stuff going on in these other series as well. So we should probably leave all of that there. Where do you want to go next?
Let's go Nuggets-Lakers, where the defending champions have built a 3-0 series lead, despite the fact that the Lakers have won all three first halves. There was a great stat tweeted out last night by OptiStats that since the NBA went to all best of seven series beginning in 2003, there have been 90 instances of a team holding a double-digit lead in each of the first three games of a playoff series. This year's Lakers are the first of those 90 teams to be down 0-3 despite that. Like, just hilarious how repetitive this series has been in terms of like every game is the same. Lakers get off to a good start. Usually AD gets off to a really good start. Jokic has like been okay, but you know, somewhat coasting through the first half. Lakers get a double digit lead, hold the lead into halftime, and then the second half comes and it's like not as simple as just the Nuggets turn it on, obviously, but like they start force-feeding Jokic a little more. Jokic starts attacking more. attacking AD more. AD starts wearing down. AD is not the same player he is in the second half as he was in the first half. And it's just like, then you look up and it's, oh, the Nuggets are up 12 now. And they're cruising to victory. Like, it is really funny. It's funny to me, and it was especially funny in game two, to hear the broadcasting team during that game, during the first half, talking about how Anthony Davis was wearing Nikola Jokic out. And like, oh, that's such a great strategy. He's attacking Jokic. And look, Jokic is, he's really out of breath. And like, all this, this is, what a strategy. It's like,
are you new here?
Yeah, are you new here? Did you not watch, like, the last 3 years of Nikola Jokic? Did you not watch last year's playoff match between these two teams? Every matchup this season. And even in game two, I could have asked, did you not watch what happened 48 hours early? Because this exact same script happened. And then literally the second half, what happened? Once Jokic starts attacking AD, it turns out the opposite is true. It's AD who actually looks worn out and worn down. And it's AD who looks like he is actually not able to sustain himself for an entire game after being relied upon so heavily in the first half and attacking Jokic the way he did. And like, I don't even say this as a criticism. I'm just like, you know, the facts are facts and players have their strengths and weaknesses. But for the most part, AD, he's never really been built to be the guy who offensively carries a team from start to finish in a game. Like, he can have great games. He's a great player, don't get me wrong. But like, that's just never been his game. And when he's been tasked with doing that, what you often see is him slowing down and breaking down a little bit in the second half. And like, even in this series, when they've, you know, I don't know, tried to wear Jokic down, if that's their strategy, AD shooting 71% in the first halves of the series, down to 52% in the second half. Obviously, still, you know, decent efficiency for a big man in the second half, but nowhere near how good he's been in the first half. He just can't.
Well, and it's really the volume, though, even more than that, that drops off for him.
Yes, he took two shots in the fourth quarter last night in a game that was still there for the taking. And I see, you know, the usual suspects just blaming that all on Darvin Ham. It's like, no, AD has to take some responsibility there, too. If he wants to take more than two shots in the fourth quarter, I promise you he would get the ball a little more. Like, it's not Coach Ham in the huddle being like, hey, guys, I know AD's having a great night, but let's stay away from him in the fourth. Like, that's not how it works, you know? And so, yeah, I think to me that's been the biggest story of the series. And other than that, I mean, the Nuggets, they're a buzzsaw, man. Jokic is what he is. Aaron Gordon had a great game three. Jamal Murray, like that game two ending, just another example of how this guy who, like, this zero-time all-star has earned a reputation as one of the ultimate playoff performers of his generation. Like, his playoff resume, again, as a zero-time all-star, is one that a lot of Hall of Famers would kill for. Like, he just incredible. And even that night, he's having a terrible shooting night, catches fire the last, what, 2.5 minutes, and then hits one of the great playoff buzzer beaters in recent memory. Just awesome stuff.
That game two was basically just like a microcosm of every season for Jamal Murray, where like the first three quarters are the regular season, and then the fourth quarter was the playoffs. And he's like, oh, okay, it's time to get serious now. I'm going to hit like five straight pull-up mid-rangers, and then I'm going to hit this dagger over the outstretched arm of, you know, a guy with a 9-foot standing reach, the self-proclaimed best defensive player in the NBA at the buzzer to send these dudes home. I mean, I guess he didn't send them home. He did. Sent them home to LA, where they lost again.
They can start packing for their summer.
Yeah, so to the AD point, I do think, and I think for this whole Lakers team, there is a question of both physical and mental stamina, where there's just a huge advantage for Denver there and the Lakers aren't able to keep up. And I mean, it's kind of to be expected, right? Like, the Nuggets are a younger, faster, more athletic team. And I don't think it should be a surprise that 39-year-old LeBron James, who is being asked to carry so much for this team at both ends of the floor, and Anthony Davis, who, he's had his injury history, he's been super healthy this season, but down the stretch of that game, it's like the 47th minute of the game, it's still within reach for the Lakers. And two straight possessions, Jokic makes the exact same slot cut, like face cuts AD, and gets layups out of that because AD can't keep up with him. And Jokic is just like going end to end with no slowing down while AD is clearly laboring. And I just think whether it's like that physical stamina or the mental stamina to kind of like stick to a game plan and remain organized on offense and keep up with everything the Nuggets are doing on defense, it just gets so difficult and you have to be so precise and locked in for the full 48 minutes to be able to do it. And I think we're just seeing the limitations of the Lakers in that regard. And there's no shame in it. Like, the Nuggets are incredible. There, I guess, is some shame in D'Angelo Russell putting up a goose egg in this game. And, like, it's one thing to miss shots, but the transition pull-up three that he took with, again, the game still more or less within reach. I think the Lakers might have been down, like, 7 points at that time when he was already ice cold. To not even give your team a chance to, like, run a play and give the ball to LeBron and let him try to organize something in that, like, that's just, that's the thing with D'Lo, right? It's the decision-making that can too often go haywire at the very wrong moments. And that is why, even when he had that nice, that really, really nice scoring spurt in the back half of the season, I did not for a moment waver in my belief that the Lakers should have taken Mike Conley instead, because you don't have to worry about that with Mike Conley when it comes to that decision making in high pressure moments. And yeah, that was just tough. But like, to the AD point, I thought part of what happened down the stretch of game two is the Nuggets made a defensive tweak where they put Aaron Gordon on AD and Jokic on Hachimura. And what that meant was KCP then became the primary on LeBron. He's obviously giving up a lot of weight in that matchup, but KCP is a fighter, man. He is a really stout and feisty defender. And I think, look, LeBron got going, man. He had a huge fourth quarter in that game too, but that shifting matchup also helped to take AD out of the game, I thought. So there's a lot going on here beyond just like AD checking out of the game or being tired, but I think it's like both of those things in tandem. And that's the same with Aaron Gordon last night going off, because nobody on the Lakers could like keep him off of the glass or away from the rim. Like I've said it before, I think he is the best dunker spot player in the NBA right now. And holy hell, did he demolish the Lakers from the dunker spot last night. Like, they had no answer for that. And it's just sort of like, I think the Lakers have actually played pretty well by their standards in this series, but it's kind of like matchup advantages all over the floor for Denver.
Yeah, and the Nuggets are just like a much better team. You know, the Lakers won, I think what they went, 46 games. They finished 10 games over 500. They're a solid
47
team.
Wins.
Yeah, 47 wins with two Hall of Famers that are still playing at like all NBA-ish levels. But the Nuggets are just a much better team. In addition to the fact that they are younger, more athletic, and all the things you said. And then, yeah, last note on Jokic, because you mentioned, like, you know, how not so much anymore, but for the most part, there was the easiest or the lowest hanging fruit with him was always like, oh, he's doughy, like not, you know, not in shape, whatever. Meanwhile, if you have followed his career at all, forget even just like looking like one of the best conditioned players in the games themselves and always being one of the last guys standing in like marathon type games, he also just like never misses time. The guy's played 70 plus games in 8 of his 9 seasons. And a couple of those seasons were seasons in which there were only 72 or 73 games on the calendar. Like, doesn't miss time. Never seems to like waver in terms of his activity or energy late in games, in the playoffs. Like, no one can ever say anything about Nikola Jokic's conditioning or physical fitness, because regardless of what you think it looks like when you just look at him standing there, he is as well conditioned as any player in the NBA. And like, he literally has the resume to prove it.
Yeah. And honestly, it was so clear how demoralized the Lakers were as soon as the Nuggets basically got back into contact in that game three. Because it's the same script over and over again. The Lakers came screaming out of the gate, built up a pretty big lead. I think they were up 9 after the first quarter. And once the Nuggets started doing their thing and kind of taking over the game, it was like, man, this again. Like, it's just got to be so, so demoralizing at this point. I mean, especially after that game two when the Lakers were up 20 and the Nuggets still came back to win. I don't know. And like they've, again, like we've said about so many teams playing Denver this year, they tried pretty much everything against Jokic. Different primary matchups, different help points, help in the post, no help in the post. Like any which way that you could think to like defend him, any look that you could throw at him, they have tried and none of it works. So that's not just a Lakers problem, but they are the team that is currently standing before it, and I don't think they're going to be standing before it for very much longer.
Yeah. The Lakers are the first team in the last 21 years to lose three straight playoff games in which they've built double-digit leads. I promise you they will not be the first team in NBA history to come back from a 3-0 deficit.
Okay, so we're going longer than we had planned. I think maybe we'll just... I don't know if we'll get to all eight series, given that we're already over 35 minutes. And touched on two, but is there one that you feel like we can toss away or one that you can feel like we can just rip through in like a couple of minutes before we take a break?
Well, I'll be honest. I mean, I just think that Thunder Pelican series with Zion out, it's not that it's not interesting to me. Like I'm obviously still watching it, but it's just so much less competitive than it could have been, even though the Pels actually put up a great fight in game one. But
arguably should have won that game.
Yeah. But I also know that you did write about that yesterday. So what I was going to say is maybe Pel's Thunder is one where, like, I don't think we have to have a full discussion about it, but maybe just, like, tell me and our listeners what you wrote about in relation to the first two games of that series.
Well, I just focused in on, like, the Jonas Valanciunas-Chet Holmgren matchup because I think that is a perfect crystallization of the trade-offs that the Thunder have been making and winning all season, where in that first game... JV pulls in, I think, 9 offensive rebounds. The Pelicans have 18 O-boards as a team. And I'm not saying that it's not a problem. It is a problem. It is clearly the biggest weakness for the Thunder and the most likely thing to ultimately undo them in their quest to win a championship this season. But it is baked into their identity and how they play. And I think... Look, like they were clearly not themselves in that game one, whether it was nerves, like they got a lot of people who were going through this for the first time. Shea has been in the playoffs a couple times before, but not as this guy who is going to be the target of all of the opposing defense's attention. I thought he struggled a bit with Herb Jones, with Najee Marshall, with their pressure, and they still managed to pull it out. And I'm just like... I'm fixated on the JV and Holmgren matchup. A, because I didn't think that at least not like permanently, I didn't think the Pelicans would actually give Holmgren that matchup over and over and over again. I thought that at some point they would do what a lot of teams have done, and even the Pelicans did this in at least one game that they played against the Thunder during the regular season, and cross-match him onto Josh Giddey. Or maybe even a Lou Dort, but not give Holmgren that matchup every time because JV is just too slow to handle Chet in space, whether it's Chet spacing him out and hitting threes or just dusting him off the bounce. So there like a couple interesting things that the Pelicans have done with that. One is like when the Thunder run pick and pop, JV is dropping back and he's not recovering back out to Chet. The rotation is coming up from the weak side corner or the weak side wing if somebody's standing there, but usually the Thunder have that wing cleared out, so it's coming up from the corner, which is tough. It's a long way to go, and then the defense has to shift behind that, but JV is basically usually recovering to the corner, and he doesn't have to try and lunge out to get to Chet because, again, he's not super mobile, and he's not good at doing that. But any sort of miscommunication, if you're a split second late, in making that rotation for the Pelicans, it's either a Chet pick and pop three or it's a swing pass and somebody is attacking a closeout and they're getting you scrambled, putting you in the blender because of their incredible driving ability. That's what this team does. They are willing to sacrifice size and heft and the ways that that burns them on the glass and occasionally in terms of interior scoring in service of stretching another team out, disorienting them with your speed, with your ball handling, with your shooting. And that has worked out in their favor, right? Like we talked about the game during the regular season where they gave up 31 rebounds to Jusuf Nurkić and they won that game.
Yeah.
They win those trade-offs. And I'm not saying that's always going to be the case. Bigger challenges are coming than the Pelicans without Zion Williamson. But I thought, especially in that game too, the fact that JV scored the first 11 points of the game for the Pelicans and 11 of the first 16 points overall, including getting a couple putbacks off of O-boards, and he wound up with 19 points in 22 minutes, and he was a minus 14 because they made him pay at the other end. And I also thought as that game went on, Chet just did a way better job in that one-on-one matchup. He blocked a JV jump hook, even though JV, like before putting it up, knocked him back like several feet, and did a much better job keeping him off the glass as well. I think the Pelicans only wound up with 8 offensive rebounds as a team in that game, which is less than JV alone had in game one. So that's the one part of the series that I'm still interested in, even though I think the Pelicans are basically drawing dead. I'm still watching that because it's going to be important for the Thunder throughout the postseason, however long it lasts for them. And every data point is important and interesting to me in how they deal with it.
Yeah, no, well said. And even me, who wrote about that glaring weakness a couple months ago, at the time when I wrote about it, it's not like I was like, well, you know, this is why they're going to get upset in the first round. I even wrote about it from the perspective of it's just whenever they end up getting eliminated. And for as good as this team is, that could be game 7 of the West Finals. For like, who knows? Maybe it ends up being in the finals. The point I was making, and I know you also get it, is that like whenever they are eventually eliminated, like when their quest for a championship comes up short this year, there are going to be people that just like pick the lowest hanging fruit of like, well, they're just too young and inexperienced. They need more seasoning. When it's like, no, it's probably going to be because of this one glaring weakness. And I still think that's the case. But the trade-off has clearly worked in the big picture when you talk about a 57 win team and the youngest number one seed ever.
Yeah. And I just came away thinking that like the Thunder in that game too were so ruthless and so precise about picking at all of New Orleans' weak spots. And I just came away thinking like, yeah, if I were the Pelicans, I would definitely think about cross-matching JV onto somebody else. But you know the Pelicans have been preparing for that, and you know they're going to have counters for it. And I just wound up feeling like they would find him and find a way to prod at his limitations no matter where he was stashed. And I think, you know, another thing is like both these teams have really good perimeter defenders, right? Herb Jones, Najee Marshall, Jose Alvarado for the Pelicans, Dyson Daniels, who hasn't got much run in this series, but hellacious point of attack defender. And then on the Thunder side, you got Lu Dort, Jalen Williams, Shea, Cason Wallace. And it was just so clear in that game too, the gulf in perimeter talent with the way that Shea and Jalen Williams were pretty easily able to shake loose. And those Pelicans perimeter, like McCollum and Ingram have just been terrible.
Yeah.
And like, if you're going to be without Zion and those guys aren't going to give you anything, like.
Yeah. And they were pretty terrible in that first play-in game too, when Zion got hurt, but carried them throughout. Like, you know, well, Ingram only played 24 minutes that night, but like,
yeah. Ingram has just not been the same since coming back from that knee injury. But,
all right, real quick. I don't know how much you want to talk Cavs Magic, but I can just quickly give some thoughts on why that series has been interesting, despite the fact no one's watching it. So the Magic did not hold a lead in this series for the first 102 minutes of basketball. Two wire-to-wire wins from the Cavs to start the series. 6 minutes of wire-to-wire leading to start game three till the Magic found their footing, caught fire from deep. But the most interesting part of this series so far to me, and the biggest adjustment made so far in this series, is that the Magic went back to starting Wendell Carter Jr. in game three in place of Jonathan Isaac, who had finally returned to the starting lineup for the last couple regular season games and the first couple playoff games. Now, I get the idea that like Jonathan Isaac's D obviously is incredible. I know people, Zach Lowe's been one of them, you know, say he, or maybe it might have been you even, I don't know, said he's maybe the best permanent defender in the NBA. Like, I get all that, and I understand the value of Jonathan Isaac even with his more limited minutes. But I also think that the Magic offense just needs all the space it can find and all the shooting it can find. And Wendell Carter Jr. has turned himself into at least a respectable threat to shoot and make from deep. And so while he only took one shot from deep last night and missed it, I think, and a lot of last night was just some unsustainable shooting from the Magic. I mean, Jalen Suggs went 9 of 11 overall from the field, but if you watch that game and compared it to the first two of the series, there was no doubt that there was more space for Paolo Banchero and his teammates to operate in with Wendell Carter Jr. out there as opposed to Jonathan Isaac. Now, do I think it's going to make enough difference for them to win the series? Probably not, but I thought it was interesting enough. And we'll see what game four looks like. Also, the Orlando crowd sounded awesome after not being in the playoffs for 5 years. But yeah, that's, to me, the interesting part of this series now is seeing how sustainable on some level Orlando's improved offense is with Carter out there and yeah, how they can keep that up.
Yeah, so I only watched the first quarter of that game because then I had to flip over to Knicks Sixers. I can't say that in the first quarter that I watched, I saw much of a difference in terms of the spacing for Orlando's offense. I think that the Cavs treated Wendell Carter pretty much the exact same way that they'd been treating Jonathan Isaac.
Really?
Yeah. So obviously something happened to change that as the game went on, or just, I know that Paolo absolutely went off in that game. So I have to watch it back to actually see what did change and what happened, but I'm not convinced that that's just like a cure-all for Orlando's offense.
Yeah.
But like,
neither am I.
And I'm not saying it was a bad adjustment. I just don't really, from what I watched, think that that is what like completely flipped things. And even like you were saying, it was unsustainable shooting for Orlando. I think that's like probably more mid-range shooting than three-point shooting, right? Because they only shot like 35% from deep.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. Even Jalen Suggs, he went 9 of 11 from the field, not from deep.
Yeah. I don't know what to take away from a game where, like, with such a blowout like that, where the Cavs just clearly didn't have it. Like, does that say anything? I'm not sure. Because what I saw in those first two games was exactly what I expected to see, which is that the Magic just don't have enough offense, enough shooting, enough shot creation to actually win a series against a good defensive team. I still feel that way. Maybe going back and watching that whole game will change my mind, but for now, I'm still in a spot where I feel comfortable about the Cavs' chances of advancing. But good for the Magic picking up that decisive win, getting back into that series, and making it interesting. Let's take the break there. We'll come back, and we'll talk about some other series.
What's up, Pound the Rock listeners? Just a friendly reminder to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. You can also check out the Score's Fantasy Football podcast with Justin Boone. And in case you haven't already, download the Score app, available on iPhone and Android. That's where you can find all of our featured content, as well as live scores, updates, and breaking news. And don't forget to check out the Score's YouTube page for an informative yet lighthearted dive into the sports world's trending topics. Now back to the show.
Okay, Cash, we are going to have to motor through the rest of this series a little bit more quickly than we have to this point, but we've gotten four out of the way. What has been the most interesting of those remaining four to you? We got Clippers, Mavs, Celtics, Heat, Wolves, Suns, Pacers, Bucks.
You know, let's go Pacers, Bucks, and the fact that Pascal Siakam's averaging about 36 points on 65% shooting through two games. And I will ask you, Wolfon, well, let me go through a little bit more. I mean, you've also got Damian Lillard wearing out in the second halves of these first couple games, very similar, like the guard version of what's been happening to Anthony Davis. You have Malik Beasley being limited to 10 minutes in game two. It's slowly happening, Wolfon. Slowly happening, as we predicted. But no, what I was going to say when I said, I'll ask you, is after mentioning that Pascal Siakam's averaging 36 points on 65% shooting, I would like to know from you, why is Doc Rivers adamant on having Brook Lopez guard him?
I think because off of the ball, you feel more comfortable with Brook sagging off of Pascal than sagging off of Miles Turner. I think because the Halliburton-Turner pick and roll is the bread and butter action for the Pacers offense, Siakam is not as good or as comfortable as a ball screener as Turner is. And if you want to have Brook be in a drop, which you do, then you're going to be more worried about Miles Turner popping out and burning that coverage. And I think you would rather the Pacers have to go away from their bread and butter and, you know, have Siakam be the ball screener if you want to put Brook Lopez in action. And then you know, if you want to keep running the Halliburton Turner pick and roll, you know, you have, I mean, like, it's not like Bobby Portis is super switchable, but you're more comfortable with that because Brook Lopez is back there and help rather than getting dragged out to the perimeter in that ball screening action. So that's, I think the logic behind it is sound. Obviously, Siakam hasn't had much of an issue with that cross-match coverage, but I also think that he has done the, maybe not the bulk of his damage, but a lot of his damage against other defenders in like transition and semi-transition because of how quickly the Pacers are playing and because the Bucks are struggling to keep up. You know, I think that was like a big storyline that we were going to be watching. The Bucks had this improved transition defense. We knew it was going to be stress tested against this Pacers offense. And I got the numbers here for you, Cash. The Pacers are at 19.1% transition frequency, which is the highest among playoff teams right now. And the Bucks are at 8.7% transition frequency. That's the second lowest among playoff teams. That's kind of the team that the Bucks are at this point, especially without Giannis.
And now Chris Middleton might be out too.
Yeah, I mean, what do they say? He's questionable or doubtful for Game 3? Like, they're
right ankle sprain, questionable.
Okay, so if it was you, knowing that Giannis is going to miss this game, but that maybe, like, cross your fingers, maybe you can get Giannis back for Game 4, would you just sit Middleton and be like, okay, we're punting this game, rest up your ankle, and we'll come back with a healthier Middleton and potentially Giannis to make an honest go of it in Game 4?
Yeah, I think if you have confidence that Giannis is coming back in Game 4, I would do that, because with how physically limited the Bucks roster is at this stage of their careers in comparison to the run-and-gun Pacers, if you know you have, you're getting Giannis back, I think you want to be as close to full strength in that game and for the rest of the series and so on after that. And so take the game for Middleton and let it happen. But if you're not sure whether Giannis is coming back, I just don't think you can even have those kind of like considerations. Like, you just got to try to win every game in front of you. And then the question there is like, well, does 75% of Chris Middleton help you there, given that he's already lost a step? I don't know. We'll have to see. But yeah, if to answer your question, if I know Giannis or I'm very confident he's coming back in Game 4, I probably let Middleton sit this one out.
Yeah. I mean, we're, by the time this podcast comes out, honestly, it's going to be close to tip off because for some reason that game is starting at 5:30 Eastern time today. So I guess we'll find out pretty soon. But yeah, any more thoughts on that series for the time being?
I feel like we should keep it rolling.
Okay.
You hit me with one.
I mean, Clippers Mavs have been super interesting through two games. Like, the Clippers come out without Kawhi, punch the Mavs in the mouth, hold them to 8 points in the second quarter of Game 1, run out to a huge lead, and, you know, the Mavs sort of chipped away at it in the second half, but never seriously threatened, and the Clippers got a comfortable win. Kawhi comes back for Game 2. You know, the Mavs made, you could say, some adjustments that I think we actually started to see them make in Game 1. The biggest one to me was not even like a tactical adjustment. It was just like Luka being way better defensively than he was in Game 1. Like, he got cooked in Game 1, and that was very much not the case in Game 2. So that was a big difference. But we can talk about some tactical stuff as well. They come back, win Game 2, get the split, going back to Dallas now. Yeah, what do you think about what we've seen in these first couple of games?
Well, I think what's interesting is, if you remember when we did our 2 minutes or less previews of each series last week, the question I had for Clippers-Mavs was, what is Ivica Zubac's utility in this series? Because I think that's a big question, and also will play a big factor in how the series is decided. And I think it's interesting that in Game 1, Zubac was great and looked like the mismatch for Dallas. Like, Dallas couldn't really contain him on the glass and inside and stuff. Had this great game. Yeah, not saying he's the reason they won that game. They won it running away. James Harden was probably the best player on the floor in that game, but he was like so good and so problematic for the Mavs in Game 1. And then Game 2, and maybe you can speak to this a little bit, perhaps schematically, and how the Mavs attacked him more. But then Game 2 came with a lot more questions, where Zubac was struggling a little bit more. Ty Lue seemed a little more hesitant to keep him on the floor even late. I think they ended up bringing him back at one point in crunch time.
They brought him back to close.
Right, but there was a stretch in the fourth quarter where they went pretty long without him, and it was kind of a question of like, oh, are they going to go back to him? And I just thought it was really interesting because it's the question we asked last week, and already we've kind of seen it through two games, right? Where it's like, oh, maybe he's got a really big role in this series, and it's going to be a problem for Dallas, and then it's game two. It's like, did they go back to him here to close? So, yeah.
Well, to be clear, it's a question you asked.
Yes.
I don't actually really have any doubts about his role in the series. I think he is super important.
Yeah.
We obviously saw that in game one, and I thought it was a very interesting tactic for the Clippers to come out basically force-feeding him in the post to kind of bully Gafford and Lively, maybe get those guys into foul trouble, and express some kind of physical advantage there. Gafford and Lively didn't have it in that game, and like they didn't really have it in game two. I think Gafford got injured at one point. Lively was okay, but what salvaged that game for the Mavs was Kleba at the five. And we keep seeing this. When Jason Kidd is not trusting his lineups, not trusting those big men, he always defaults to Kleba at the five. That is like his security blanket that makes him feel comfortable. And it's hard to argue like that lineup or that lineup configuration has been by far the best for Dallas in this series. They rode Kleba at center lineups to the conference finals a couple years ago. Kleba is not the player that he was 2 years ago, but he's still a really good defender. And so if you can get the added spacing that comes with having him at the five, and also I think he's a better screener straight up than either Gafford or Lively is. And it's not like you can't have him set ball screens when he's playing the four, but it's just not as effective when you have a non-shooting five out there and another Clippers defender who's going to be standing basically clogging up the paint as a result of that. When Kleba's at the five and he gets a chance to showcase that screening ability because he's going to become your primary ball screener, or you're just going to have him spotting up because you want to go five out and have Luka or Kyrie ISO, that can facilitate better offense and you don't lose much, if anything, at the defensive end of the floor by doing that. So I understand it. I think you lose some things. You lose, obviously, like the vertical pop, the interior finishing, the roll gravity, things that I think have benefited Dallas down the stretch after they added Gafford. But he has not had it through these first couple of games. And the fact that Kidd has that lineup that he can fall back on, I think is a valuable thing. It's a nice ace to have in the hole. And I don't even know if I call it an ace in the hole because like they've leaned on it very heavily. We're talking about 32 minutes through two games. So it's not like some sparingly used thing, but it's just not what we saw them going to down the stretch of the season. We saw them usually rolling with one of the traditional bigs on the floor. And now they're going back to this this Kleba center look that has been successful for them at various points in the past. And I think that just, to me, what I was seeing when they had a traditional five out there was just too many easy help points for the Clippers defense, because they're helping way off of Derek Jones Jr. and they're helping way off of PJ Washington as well. So throwing another like non-shooting five into the mix just makes it tough, I think, for their offense to generate the space they need inside the arc.
Yeah, and for the record, I really like Ivica Zubac. I think he's been one of the more underrated players in the league for a couple of years now, and people understate his value. But to all your points, if the Mavs continue to rely on those Kleba at center five out lineups and they remain Dallas's best option, and they lean into it more heavily as the series goes on, can the Clippers have Ivica Zubac out there?
I think so.
Okay.
Because I think that the Mavs are still going to have to put some defensive-minded players on the floor. And whether that's a Derrick Jones Jr., even Washington, right? Like, I think you could get away with cross-matching Zubac onto PJ Washington. I know he made a couple big threes down the stretch of that game, but for the bulk of that game, Kawhi was guarding PJ Washington and not paying him very much attention on the perimeter. He was roving and mucking stuff up as a helper. And honestly, I think you could survive putting Zubac on Kleba. Like, Kleba is a 33% three-point shooter. Like, you don't... He's going to get them up. He's going to hit a few, which is a big difference from, like, Lively or Gafford. And it's going to make it a little bit more difficult for Zubac to sit in that deep, deep drop that he was sitting in when they were running, you know, Luka Gafford or Luka Lively pick and rolls. But I don't think you're, like, sunk if Zubac has to guard Maxi Kleba. Like, he's not that good of a stretch big. So, yeah, I think you want to press your advantages when you can find them. And if it's like, okay, the Mavs are going small, there will definitely be some points where the Clippers go small as well. We saw that in game two. They had a run where it was basically Kawhi at center. But that doesn't mean that Zubac is like getting played out of this series by any means. I think his defense is too important to the Clippers. And we saw at various points in games one and two how important his offense can be for them as well. You know, like, we talk about what the Mavs potentially lose with their big guys going to the bench. Like, without Zubac, it's just, I don't know if they're getting like enough interior scoring from their other guys at this point, even if they can theoretically space out, like go five out, have all that space to attack inside the arc. Kawhi just isn't that guy who's like attacking, getting all the way to the rim at this stage. Harden is not that guy either. Paul George, kind of that guy. Norm Powell can be that guy, but, you know, we can talk about how the Mavs targeted and exploited him on defense. It's there's always going to be these trade-offs. That's why I think this series is so fascinating. Like, just a very interesting chess match in terms of the lineups alone. Like, forget about tactics. It does concern Zubac, but, like, mainly it concerns, I think, how the Clippers want to defend Luka. Because I think what we saw is, like, they want to keep Zubac in drop. They want to try and defend those actions two-on-two if they can. And there was some switching. Like, Zubac did switch out a couple of times. There was a couple of blitzes. More so against Kyrie, but against Luka, they seemed comfortable in drop. And a huge shout out to Terrence Mann, who made that coverage work with his incredible screen navigation. It was less successful when James Harden was the one guarding Luka. Like, that drop coverage does not look as good when you have Harden chasing versus Terrence Mann. But I think they're, like, whether it's the step back three against the switch, or whether it's like a pull up mid-ranger, a step back mid-ranger, or a floater against the drop, they seem willing to live with that stuff if it's limiting Luka's playmaking avenues. And I think the Dallas counter to that, where Luka is like seeking out Norman Powell and taking those guys into the post, that's when the Clippers are committing the extra defender. That's when the Mavs are getting the ball popping, putting the Clippers in rotation. That's what's helping Kyrie really get going in the half court. And I think that's an interesting counter that I'm curious to see how the Clippers react to it. Coming into the series, my big question was, like, how are the Clippers going to guard Luka? And I think there have been all kinds of interesting answers and new questions about that in these first couple of games. You're good with that on Clippers Mavs?
I'm good there.
All right, where are we going next then?
Let's go Timberwolves Suns, which is probably the series I was most looking forward to coming into the playoffs. Timberwolves win the first two at home, almost appear to break the Suns' spirit early, but it's two games. Phoenix is going home. I don't think this series is over by any stretch. I think it's interesting that the Suns are actually getting to the rim far more often than they did in the regular season through the first two games. It's just that they have not been successful there, which is something you talked about last week anyway with Gobert and the Timberwolves' rim deterrence. They are still not taking enough threes, really. So even though they're getting to the rim, I still don't like their overall shot profile. And then what I think is interesting is, so my question last week was, how are the Suns going to guard Anthony Edwards? Because I just didn't think that they had many good answers for him. And what I thought, the reason I asked that question and why I thought it was so interesting is because during the regular season, numbers-wise, the Suns were one of the best teams at guarding Anthony Edwards, right? And it just didn't make a lot of sense to me when you looked at their personnel and even going into this playoff match. So I was like, I don't understand how they're going to guard this guy. I don't like the matchup for them. I think Ant is going to have a big series. He has that great game one. And I came out of that thinking, like, see, this is why the regular season matchup never made sense to me, because how were they limiting him in the regular season? He's just going to feast all series. Sure enough, in game two, he did struggle again, as he did in the regular season against this team. So what is it about, even though they're down 2-0, and obviously they're not in good position going forward in this series, what is it about this Suns team that personnel-wise other than Royce O'Neal, who doesn't even start for them, although with Grayson Allen banged up, maybe he will now. What is it about this Suns personnel that you do think for the most part has given Ant trouble? Because again, I'm looking at it and it's like, well, they got Beal on him. And then the next possession down, it's like, yeah, Grayson Allen, who's a good defender, but doesn't have the size. And then once in a while they have Book, who competes, but, you know, isn't a standout defender. And it's like, but then you look at the end of the day and it's, oh, Ant really struggled to get his points in this game. Again, other than game one.
Yeah, because defense is not really a mono type of thing these days. And it's more about the team scheme, I think, where they're showing him a lot of bodies. You know, like shading over from one pass away, really junking up his driving lanes. And yeah, he might have a favorable individual matchup, but with the amount of help that they're showing him, that doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to find his way to easy baskets. And I give Ant a lot of credit for the way that he's handled that coverage. Like, he has been very willing to get off the ball early, making the simple pass that is helping to put the Suns in rotation. And a lot of times, especially in game one, the ball finds its way back to him in a more advantageous position, like giving it up to get it back. The Suns have kind of stuck to their guns and continued to go with the kind of like overload style of defense that they want to play against him. That's why you see a game two where Ant, I don't know what he wound up shooting in that game, but it was not a very efficient game for him at all. But somebody like Jaden McDaniels absolutely goes off because he's getting open catch and shoot threes and he's getting closeouts to attack. And that is the trade-off that you have to make if you are the Suns, because you don't have an elite individual wing stopper who can just throw at Ant and be like, hey, you handle that. We're not going to help. It's all you. There are pros and cons to doing what they're doing against him. I give the Wolves a lot of credit for exploiting it, but you know, I think to a certain extent, you also kind of have to tip your cap to the Suns for being able to execute that coverage as far as like limiting Ant, at least in game two. It obviously didn't work for, the second half of game one. But yeah, that's kind of, I guess, what it comes down to me. And like you mentioned off the top, the Grayson Allen injury, which might not seem like a huge deal, but given how top heavy the Suns are, how little depth they have, that could sink them. Yeah. They might be sunk anyway, but like that could be the nail in the coffin, losing Grayson Allen. They just don't have any depth. Yeah. Like I don't know what to say other than that. It's like you're watching them play high leverage playoff minutes with Drew Eubanks and Eric Gordon on the floor, and that's not going to cut it.
I do want to mention, just to build off your point of how well Anthony Edwards has handled the scheme that the Suns have thrown at him. One thing I've noted like all year is that what I've been so impressed by Anthony Edwards with this season is that I feel like he has taken some steps in things that won't appear necessarily on a box score. Like, for example, the way he's getting off the ball when pressure comes and the decisions he's making when it comes and the way he's reading the floor. And what I've been impressed by that is because I feel like he's taken those steps and for lack of a better term, seems like a more educated offensive alpha this year in ways that usually a guy has to go through more playoff failure to get to that point. And with Ant, I feel like he's kind of learning quicker, if that makes sense, than a lot of young alphas usually do. Like, I feel like we usually see a guy really struggle for a couple of postseasons or really take his playoff lumps a few times before starting to read the floor and defenses the way Ant has this season. And I just think he deserves a lot of credit for that because, you know, I'm not saying he's already had this great playoff resume. I know that, but there's not a lot of playoff experience there. And so for him to make those adjustments and improve in those areas already, I think is really impressive and bodes well for both he and the Timberwolves going forward.
Absolutely. And the fact that he has made tremendous strides at the defensive end of the floor just kind of further that as far as him being a serious playoff performer. Like having your star player be that good at both ends is just such an enormous advantage. And I mean, the story of the series at the end of the day, we're talking about the Wolves offense versus the Suns defense, but like the story of the series so far is the Wolves defense.
Yeah.
And you mentioned like the Suns getting to the rim or shooting at the rim at least more than you kind of expected them to. but not shooting well there. Like, they're shooting 53% at the rim in this series. I think to a certain extent, that's by design, where part of the Wolves' scheme has been to funnel their guys toward Rudy Gobert. And, like, their perimeter defenders have been so aggressive. And even if it winds up with them picking up fouls, it feels like they've just decided they're okay with that, that eventually it's going to wear them down and they are going to give up. And that is what's happened in the second half of both of these first two games, right? Like, we know the Suns have had turnover issues all season. They had 19 turnovers in game two. Like, they're really struggling to deal with all of this pressure from Jaden McDaniels, Nikhil Alexander-Walker, Ant himself. It's a lot, man. And the Wolves decided they wanted to put Jaden on Devin Booker and have Kat guard Kevin Durant. KD, as a result of that, had a very big scoring game in game one. But, like, the Wolves kind of decided they were willing to live with that because they see Booker more as, like, the head of the snake and the guy that is more effective initiating the Suns' offense. And they would rather take him out of the game with Jaden McDaniels and his ability to get around screens and smother ball handlers with his length and speed. And I thought that worked out really well because, yeah, KD had 31 points, 31 efficient points, but he had one assist and five turnovers. And Booker couldn't do shit. And then it's like you have the option when Nikhil Alexander-Walker comes onto the floor to then shift Jaden McDaniels to Kevin Durant and put Nikhil Alexander-Walker on Devin Booker, and the pressure and the screen navigation doesn't change. Like, that's a very big luxury. So, yeah, not that it needs saying, like we've been saying it all season, but very impressed with the Wolves defense in this series. And I know I said this to you off air, but, like, I wouldn't be surprised if the Suns win both of their games at home. Like, weird shit like that happens, especially with jump shooting oriented teams like Phoenix. I do think without Grayson Allen, that's going to be a lot tougher, but I think regardless, coming into the series, when we talked about it, I know I said, like, we weren't making picks, but if I was making a pick, I would have picked the Wolves, but I was, like, not super confident in that because I felt like the Suns had like, kind of the bigger matchup advantages despite being a worse team, and that hasn't borne out at all. I think I've, like, over-indexed a little bit on their regular season matchups and just didn't consider how difficult it would be for their strangely underwhelming offense to get going against this ferocious Timberwolves defense.
Yeah, and I did just want to ask you, Wolfon, what are the Suns elite at?
Letting go of the rope, baby.
Yeah. So, while I'm with you, and like I said, I can definitely see them winning, maybe even both at home. I just don't know how much faith I have in this, especially without Grayson Allen. Yeah. You know what this series is to me? It's like the classic example of, and I'm not saying us, because I think we both thought the Timberwolves were going to win this series, but to me, it's the classic example of, like, the kind of series where maybe a more casual fan would just look at it and be like, yeah, I know the Timberwolves were the much better team in the regular season, but Phoenix has Kevin Durant and Devin Booker and Bradley Beal, and so now it's the playoffs and it'll be different. But it's like, no, like, the Timberwolves, for the most part, are showing you why they were the better team all season, because they are the better team with the league's best defense by a mile all year. So, yeah.
Okay. Cash, I'm going to let you cook on this one, man. Heat Devil Magic did it again.
Yeah. So the funny thing is, through, you know, as I was compiling notes for what I knew was going to eventually be our episode this week, going through every series, and I was compiling notes, you know, from the moment the playoffs started. And after one game of this series and just looking around the and obviously looking at their potential second round matchup against one of Cleveland or Orlando, the only note I had through one game of the series was, like, nothing about the series itself or tactically. It was straight up going to be, hey, Wolfon, like, over under 1.5 Celtics losses through the first two rounds of the playoffs. And instead, after game two, we end up having to talk about that Heat Devil Magic I know you love to talk about, like, because
I will say, I remember, like, we were at an event talking about this series when it was clear that the Heat were going to run away with that second play-in game against Chicago. And we were like, watch, man. It feels on paper like it should be a sweep, but we know some weird, wonky Heat voodoo shit is going to happen. And here we are.
And it did, yeah. And, like, Yeah, so, you know, we did have that conversation. Like I said, I was going to, after game one, I was just ready to ask how many losses the Celtics will have, if any, through the first two rounds, because I thought that they'd mollywop the Heat through these first two games. But oops, how dare I count out Heat culture? But no, obviously, in all seriousness, this was not, to me, you might argue that, yes, it was, because it's always been smoke and mirrors. But to me, this wasn't the regular Heat culture thing where it's like, look, as I've always said over the years, and everyone's wondering about the voodoo devil magic, it's like, no, they've got Jimmy Butler, a solid team, and Eric Spoelstra. Like, there's a reason why they succeed in the playoffs. In this case, they didn't have Jimmy Butler. They were 14.5-point underdogs in Boston against the team that ran away from the pack this season and lapped the field. And yet, again, they find a way. Like, every year, Eric Spoelstra's Heat find a way to surprise us. And this year, it's stealing a game on the road without Jimmy Butler against a 64-win Celtics team that was favored by 14.5. Now, the way you do that is by hitting 95% of your 153-point attempts and tapping into what Wolf One likes to call devil magic, because it should be unsustainable, and yet it's really not for the Heat in the playoffs against the Celtics. As Wolfon provided me with, shared a tweet with me the night the Heat won game two, from Cooper Moorhead on Twitter. Miami now has four playoff games in the past two seasons with 50% shooting from three against the Celtics. No other team in the league has more than one period against anyone. So in this case, and the way game two went, I am actually okay with calling it devil magic. In this specific case, I think it was a little bit of that voodoo stuff, and I'm not really that worried for Boston. Again, don't get me wrong, that doesn't mean the Heat didn't play well and defend their ass off, and it doesn't mean Bam wasn't great on both sides of the ball in this game, but to me, this was really an example where it's like, I don't know how much more I chalk it up to than just they went absolutely batshit crazy from three. And I know it's going to make it now easy for everyone to jump on. They're like, well, see, the Celtics were never as good as their juggernaut record and stats indicated. And I don't trust this offense. And they shoot 23s and like, blah, blah, blah. Like, okay, let's calm down there. Like, can we please not forget that the 66-win championship Big Three Celtics in 2008 went seven games with the 37-win Hawks in the first round? Like, let's not get carried away here. And that's me saying that. Mr. Heat culture.
Yeah, I mean, I can't believe I'm going to be the one playing devil's
advocate. I think I've disappointed you, Wolf.
Yeah, no, I was hoping you were going to ride in, touting the hardest working, best conditioned, most unselfish, nastiest, meanest, best looking team in the NBA. But I guess I'm going to have to do that instead. So look, the shooting is what it is. That's just crazy. That stat from Cooper Moorhead is one of the craziest that I've seen in a really long time. Because it's not interesting to talk about shot-making variance, I don't want to spend too much time on that. I want to focus instead on the very interesting Miami defensive adjustments in this game. Now, I'm calling them adjustments. I actually didn't watch game one of this series. It's one of like the very few games in this postseason that I haven't seen yet. So maybe they did this out of the gate, but I didn't hear about it, so I'm going to just assume that this was an adjustment they made. But they had Bam as like the primary on Jason Tatum for most of this game. And they had, for a lot of it, Tyler Hero as the primary on Jaylen Brown. And they're also, like, I've talked about this a couple times, for a lot of this season, actually veered away from switching and had Bam more in like drop coverage. And it had been kind of like part of their defensive identity that they leaned away from this year in order to make up for the fact that like they didn't have a ton, or at least not as much perimeter defensive talent as maybe they've had in the past. They go back to the switch everything scheme in this game. And I think it really took the Celtics out of their flow. And I think for one thing, like the Hero on Jaylen Brown thing was very fascinating to me, because I remember having this conversation with you about like the pros and cons of soft switching, where it's like, obviously you give up the matchup that the offense wants to get to, but you minimize miscommunications that way if everybody just knows that that's what you're doing on all these ball screens. And also, like I cited Hero specifically as an example where the Heat were having tied themselves in knots to keep themselves out of these switches. And I wondered whether it might not be better to just give the switch and then deal with it later. Like, you probably still wind up bringing help, but maybe you're doing it later in the possession where the Celtics have less time to take advantage of it, rather than it's two on the ball right off the bat and the ball's swinging around and the Celtics have a whole possession to get a good shot out of that. Giving the Celtics an objectively advantageous matchup off the jump, I just think it's like an interesting tactical, it's like a mind game almost. It's like, all right, you want to just like go at this, like give the ball to Jaylen Brown and have him ISO? Like, you can do that, but it's kind of going to disrupt your offensive flow. Other guys maybe aren't going to be as involved. We're going to find different help points maybe to pick at it. And also, like, they're having him switch onto Porzingis, and holy hell did Porzingis have a bad game. Couldn't do anything against Hero on the backside of these switches. Bam was fantastic defensively, and Tatum and Brown still had good offensive games, but nobody else on the Celtics did. And I think you have to give the Heat credit for that, the way that they decided to defend. I don't know if we're going to see this exact same look in game three. I'd be surprised if we did. That's kind of the genius of Eric Spoelstra, right? He can throw something out for a game. Maybe the Celtics go into game three having prepared for it and the Heat do something completely different. But I thought tactically that was like an interesting choice to make, that, you know, we can talk about the threes all we want, but like, it was a really, really good defensive performance from Miami.
Yep.
And I thought Hero was kind of the pivot point there, where he held up way better than I would have expected in some of those mismatches. And something we think about, like, the changing officiating points of emphasis. And in my mind, that's always like, oh, that benefits these like big bruising physical defenders. And that game, watching it, especially like with the way that he handled Porzingis on those switches, was like, you know, maybe the type of player who benefits most from this is somebody like a Hero, who is physically at a disadvantage, but is now being given more leeway to be a little bit more handsy and be more physical. Like, I think that's a big part of what happened in that game.
No, I think that's a great observation. And I come out of these two games now seriously asking the question, like, when we had that discussion off air last week about how, you know, like, just watch, some weird shit will happen. Or, like, you know, I think I made the joke, like, Nikola Jovic is going to have, like, a 20-10-5 game in one of these games and steal a game in the series. It was all a joke, and I still expected it to be a Celtics sweep without Jimmy Butler, or at most, a five-game series. But I joked at the time that, oh, it'll somehow go back to Boston tied 2-2. Again, it was a joke. But now I'm sitting here genuinely asking you the question after the Heat took one game in Boston to start the series. Do you think this series eventually goes back to Boston 2-2 or not? You think that that outlier game happened and now we end up seeing what we should have seen, which was a Boston team that was favored by 14.5 goddamn points in game 2 for a reason without Jimmy Butler?
Yeah, I think if I were to bet on an outcome, I would bet on it going back to Boston with the Celtics up 3-1.
Yeah,
I don't think I'd be super surprised if it was 2-2, but I think looking at it holistically, I don't think that the Celtics are in any real danger here.
Agreed.
But you can never count out Eric Spoelstra and the Miami Heat. Usually I would have said you can't count out Spo and Jimmy Butler and Bam.
Yeah.
But now Jimmy's not there, so I guess you can't count out Spo and Bam and Tyler Hero and his merry band of role players, Caleb Martin, like, who turns into Steph Curry every time he sees Celtics green, apparently. Like, you just don't know what they're going to come up with, how many threes they're going to hit. Like, Jimmy Butler's just a man, you know? Heat Devil Magic is an idea, and that's something you can't kill.
You can't kill culture.
Is that enough?
I think that's enough. I've saddled you with a 90-minute edit here. I think that's enough.
Okay, so let's skip a fan shout-out for today, because we've already gone too long.
Yeah. And I do have a good one banked for next week. So,
okay, great. Looking forward to that. Hopefully we'll be able to get in a pithier episode. I mean, it's tough in the playoffs when there's so much to talk about, but when the field gets winnowed down, it becomes easier. I mean, talking about 8 series and 16 teams is tough to do in less than 80 minutes. So enjoy this episode, enjoy your weekend, and we'll be back next week to talk about what at that point will be, I think, the tail end of the first round. So until then, for Joseph Cacciaro, I'm Joe Wolfon. Pound the Rock.